Welcome, members and guests, to the December 13th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to KLCC listeners and to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, the City Club president. Our sponsors today are John Brown of Evans Elder and Brown, Network Charter School, Dot Dotson's, PAC Info, and Maryland Milne Public Relations Services, and Essex General Construction. A special thank you, as always, to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night, and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and help keep the organization healthy. If you act now with a donation through the Oregon Cultural Trust, you may have your contribution matched and also receive up to a $500 tax credit. And without further ado, I will ask John DeWinter to come up. He's our organizer for the program, along with Joanne Ernst and Vincenzo Scarpacci.
Thank you, Marty. This is the last of three programs about the management of forest lands, principally federal forest lands in Oregon. Our first program, which was in October, featured as speakers forestry professors Jerry Franklin and Norm Johnson, who gave us a scientist's perspective on forest management. Last month, our program focused on ONC forest lands and told us how the timber and wood products industry and the Association of ONC Counties believe those lands should be managed. Today's program continues the focus on ONC forest lands, but it will provide us the views of a conservationist and those of an economist who has analyzed the monetary value of conserving, that is, not harvesting, the ONC lands. Our conservationist is Greg Haller, the conservation director of Pacific Rivers Council, which is headquartered in Portland. Greg has over 10 years' experience working on complex river basin management issues with others representing opposing interests. He is a native of Ithaca, New York, where he grew up fly fishing nearby waters with his dad. He holds a master's degree in environmental management and natural resource economics from Cornell University and a law degree from the University of Idaho. Ernie Niemi is our economist. Ernie started his own business named Natural Resource Economics in Eugene in 2012. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry at the University of Oregon. He also received a master's degree in city and regional planning from Harvard University. You might ask how this education qualifies him as an economist. It may not. What does qualify him is his work experience. From 1978 to 2012, he worked as a senior economist at Eco Northwest in Eugene. His specialties include applying principles of cost-benefit analysis, economic valuation, and economic impact analysis in the context of natural resource management. I should add that the analysis Ernie will be discussing today was prepared for Pacific Rivers Council, Greg's organization. Please welcome Greg Haller and Ernie Niemi.
Thank you, John. Hello, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today about this important topic. I'm not sure of everyone's background on the ONC lands issue, and so I'll give you a little background on that, as well as our approach to the ONC issue as well, and then I'll conclude with a brief overview of recent legislation proposed by Senator Wyden and sort of our opinions about that. As many of you might know, the history of the ONC is intertwined with the early policies of expansion and settlement of the American West. After the Civil War, Congress began offering land grants to assist with settlement and the transportation of goods in the western United States. And in 1866, Oregon received a large grant of those lands, in a every square mile area, basically from Portland on down to the California border. Oregon, in turn, offered those lands to the ONC Railroad to build a railway from Portland to California, as well as to sell the land to settlers under certain stipulations, including that they be bona fide settlers. The price would be $250 an acre, and no more than 160 acres would be sold to a single bidder. ONC Railway promptly violated those stipulations. They did start building the railroad, but they auctioned off those lands to the highest bidder, and primarily those were timber lands. Oregon went to Congress to seek redress of these violations, and Congress responded by passing legislation that revested these lands back to the federal government, and in 1937 it passed the ONC Lands Act, which put management of these forests with the General Lands Office, which is the precursor to the BLM. I mentioned that the original land grant was every other mile or every other section, and that created a checkerboarded land ownership landscape, and that issue I will touch on a little later because it has implications for the management of these lands. The ONC Lands Act required that these lands be managed for the sustainable timber sustainable timber output and other values, not just timber, like watershed health. And that counties would receive 50% of the timber receipts for governmental services. Following World War II, there was a big building boom, of course, and as a result, rampant overharvest, primarily in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, with the liquidation of old growth resources on the horizon. That prompted numerous lawsuits and eventually the endangered species listing of the northern spotted owl, the development of the Northwest Forest Plan, and later the listing of the coho salmon. And as you're all aware, timber receipts have declined since those days. County budgets have taken a hit. Congress responded with the Secure Rural Schools Act to fund essential government services. And we are here we are today. As I mentioned, ONC lands are managed under the Northwest Forest Plan, which was put in place in 1994. And the Northwest Forest Plan covers 24 million acres across Washington, Oregon, and California. The plan sets up a series of land use allocations, such as late successional reserves, riparian reserves, matrix, which is where the primary harvest of timber would occur, adaptive management areas, and key watersheds. Management of these allocations is laid out in a series of standards, guidelines, and strategies, including the aquatic conservation strategy, watershed assessments, survey and manage, and monitoring. For example, key watersheds are intended to serve as refugia for aquatic organisms and at-risk fish species. And these areas are the areas likely to have the greatest potential for restoration or to provide sources of high-quality drinking water. Any management in key watersheds must be consistent with those values. The Northwest Forest Plan is arguably one of the most successful land and water management plan in the United States. In 2008, I believe, the Forest Service released a report called Watershed Condition and Trend, which analyzed trends in watershed health as determined by in-stream conditions and upland conditions over the first 15 years of the plan. The analysis concluded that 69% of the nearly 1,800 watersheds analyzed showed an improvement in watershed health, primarily driven by decommissioning roads in landslide-prone areas. Now, I know a lot of you are familiar with these landscapes, and as a river conservation organization, we focused primarily on aquatic resources in this ONC lands issue. ONC lands contain some of Oregon's perhaps the nation's most iconic salmon and steelhead rivers, including the Rogue, North Umpqua, Nestucca, and Mackenzie, nearly 1,400 miles of rivers that support fish and wildlife, and probably some of the best remaining wild salmon rivers south of Canada. People come from around the world to fish and recreate on these lands and rivers. ONC lands also provide clean drinking water. Oregon DEQ estimates that 75% of ONC lands are vital to providing drinking water to 1.8 million Oregonians. Approximately 81 providers, water providers, source their water from ONC lands. And of course, these lands are contain some of the remaining stands of old growth forests and habitat for spotted owls, murrelets, and tree voles. So I'm going to talk just briefly about some of the threats to these aquatic values. Although timber harvest has declined substantially since the bad days of the 70s and 80s, the road system that supported that level of harvest, in our view, is the number one threat to aquatic values today. Poorly designed roads act as chronic sources of sediment that impact fish habitat and water quality. And when a rain on snow event occurs, these roads simply liquefy, choking streams with tons of sediment and destroying habitat. Road densities on OODC lands are 3 to 6 times higher than what science tells us are good for fish or protective of fish. Another issue in the waters on OODC lands is the lack of large wood. And this is also a legacy of the harvest of big trees in the past. Large woody debris creates habitat complexity and pools, eddies, and other fish features where juvenile and adult fish utilize. Road building, et cetera, has basically cut off the supply of that large wood, and that's a problem. I mentioned before the checkerboard nature of the landscape, and to us that is also a primary threat to the protection and restoration of these resources. Private lands are managed under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which has some of the weakest protections for fish and water compared to Washington and California and even Idaho with regard to pesticide use. OFPA has minimal buffers on fish-bearing streams, no buffers on non-fish-bearing streams, and it allows the aerial application of dangerous herbicides like atrazine, which is a known hormone disruptor and carcinogen. And to just give you an example of what the checkerboard nature means for fish that are traversing up and down these waterways, as salmon migrate to and from the ocean, they swim through waters on federal lands where approximately 40% of each acre is protected for water quality and stream health. But as the fish crosses onto private forest lands, only 3 to 5% of that land is protected for aquatic health. This disparity places the overwhelming burden on maintaining fish and wildlife habitat on federal lands. And finally, political pressure resulting from depressed rural economies, which are a result of a host of factors, which Ernie will discuss, we view that as also as an external threat to environmental values, but also to the continued viability of the Northwest Forest Plan. So PRC, we're an aquatics group. We work to protect rivers, their watersheds, and the native aquatic species that depend on them. And we have a long history in the Northwest Forest Plan and the development of the aquatic conservation strategy. We were part of the litigation that against the BLM during the Bush administration when the BLM wanted to roll back many of the protections in the Northwest Forest Plan to increase the harvest of trees. Last year, we were a member of the Governor Kitzhaber's task force on ONC, and we've continued to be involved in this process since. As you all are aware, Representative Fazio introduced a bill last year that actually passed through the House. And what was notable about that bill, amongst other things, was that the Oregon Forest Practices Act was going to be applied to the federal landscape. That was a wake-up call for us. I think Congressman DeFazio was probably somewhat constrained being in the minority in a rather conservative House, but I think he did probably set the stage for Senator Wyden to kind of increase protections in his proposal. And as you are aware, or maybe not, the Northwest Forest Plan is an action of the executive agency, of the executive branch of government, which means that it can be changed by future administrations, much like the BLM tried to do in the Bush era. Now, there are different opinions about whether the political pressure on regarding county funding and the ONC and whether the ONC lands are an integral part of the Northwest Forest Plan or if they actually threaten the continued viability of it. So looking across the options that we see for dealing with these issues. We had a DeFazio bill. We know that the Western Oregon plan revisions, or the resource management plan planning process, is beginning as well on the BLM. And we know that Senator Wyden has recently introduced legislation. So when we look at those options for dealing with protecting of aquatics, we thought, what's our best option here to really conserve the aquatic resources? Well, we know what DeFazio's bill did and didn't do. We really don't know what the BLM is going to do, but we have a pretty good idea that it's going to attempt to do what it did in 2008, which was roll back many of the protections in the ONC. I'll just talk briefly about the Wyden bill, and I'm sure some of you have read it, but essentially it deals with 2.2 million acres of the ONC lands, and like the DeFazio proposal, Wyden proposes to manage lands in two broad categories: forestry emphasis areas and conservation emphasis areas. Lands in the forestry emphasis areas would be managed for permanent timber production under the principles of sustained yield and variable retention harvest, or ecological forestry as it's known by its proponents, and thinning for the purpose of providing a permanent timber supply and protecting watersheds. Within forestry emphasis areas, harvest of old growth trees would be prohibited with very limited exceptions, and old growth is defined as stands average, where the average age of the stand is 120 years and the individual tree is of 150 years old. Management would include variable retention harvests with one-third green trees retained. Now, that's actually more than what's currently allowed under the Northwest Forest Plan. I believe the Northwest Forest Plan allows that type of harvest with only a 15% green tree retention. Harvest shall be designed so that the sale does not result in measurable significant impacts on water quality consistent with the applicable laws. One of the issues that we've noted in the Wyden bill is that water quality is considered at the time of determination to determine the present condition, and then 5 years later, and then 2 years after the date of the timber sale. That might be problematic, and we're working with the senator to refine some of that language. In the conservation emphasis areas, those lands will be managed for ecological and conservation benefits, including old growth, clean air, water quality, filtration, purification, watershed health, soil stabilization, biodiversity, connectivity, long-term storage of carbon, and recreation. Harvest may be permitted to improve the health of the forest in those areas through thinning or some variable density harvest in stands up to 80 years old, only if it improves habitat for T&E, threatened and endangered species, or for watershed health. Importantly, as I mentioned, the roads, no new or temporary roads shall be built in these conservation emphasis areas. And as I mentioned before, we see roads as the primary threat to aquatic health in the ONC. The bill would also prioritize decommissioning of roads on steep slopes and roads that cause or at risk of causing sedimentation. It also establishes for the first time the Legacy Roads and Trails program, which actually PRC helped to bring into being on for the Forest Service. The BLM will now have a similar program. Fortunately, the bill doesn't provide any money for that, but LRT basically is the fund that we use for decommissioning of roads. Within the conservation emphasis areas, the full aquatic conservation strategy as it currently exists will apply. So that means in the riparian reserves, the buffers would be equal to two tree lengths or 300 feet, whichever is greater, on fish-bearing streams. And on non-fish-bearing streams, it would be of one tree length. Watershed analysis will occur to ensure adequate protections are being provided and may consider changes to those buffers in the future. The bill establishes new recreation areas in the Rogue and Malala, the Illinois Valley Salmon and Botanical Area Special Management Unit, backcountry management areas, and also provides provisions for land ownership consolidation. Importantly, it also establishes new designations for drinking water source areas. This is a new designation, federal designation, that would protect source water drinking areas with a full aquatic conservation strategy and prohibit grazing. Now, not everything is perfect in this bill. None of them are. A couple of our concerns have to do with NEPA. Senator Wyden proposes that there would be 2 10-year environmental impact statements for each of the dry and moist forest lands identified for management. So a chunk of the landscape would be set aside, say 50,000 acres, and in that 10 years, management would occur under an EIS for that period. There would be a compressed time frame for commenting to kind of accelerate planning. And of concern is that, you know, under current NEPA, you can challenge a programmatic EIS, and you can also challenge the timber sale as well. Senator Wyden actually eliminates that provision. You only get one bite at the apple, as he says. You can challenge the EIS, but you can't challenge the timber sale or timber projects underneath it. The agencies would develop a consistency document to show that timber sale was actually consistent with the EIS. There's also some concerns with regard to the ESA. It does maintain consultation. The wording of the bill is a little tricky, and we're working with the senator to actually straighten that up, because he's been very clear that there would be no changes to the ESA in this legislation. So as we move forward, we're going to continue to work with Senator Wyden to try to make these improvements to the bill. You know, we understand that there's a lot of controversy over the types of timber harvest that's going to occur on this landscape. And I think there's legitimate debates over whether the variable retention harvesting, or the ecological forestry as it's known, is better or worse than thinning. PRC's view is that the thinning approach to management of these lands is problematic for water. Thinning requires a massive road network to continue to do that activity now and into perpetuity. And we don't, as identified and as has been identified, roads are the number one problems for aquatic health in these areas. So we don't really see thinning as a viable answer here for aquatic health. That said, we understand there's some concerns with the ecological forestry as championed by Dr. Franklin and Dr. Johnson. I think those are legitimate concerns, and I'm sure the folks that are most interested in that will be done. Sorry, I couldn't read your sign.
NEPA is an
EPA. Oh, sorry. NEPA, for those that don't know, is the National Environmental Policy Act and ESA Endangered Species Act. And I'm not sure where I am in my time, but I think I'll wrap it up there and turn it over to Ernie.
Thank you. My name is Ernie Niemi. I am an economist. I think I can lay claim to that given my training and my experience. I actually started working on these issues back in the 1970s when in Douglas County, Coos Curry, and Coos County. I actually worked for the timber industry for a while on federal land management issues. What I want to talk about today are the two main reasons that I've heard as I've gone across Western Oregon that people give for justifying or calling for an increase in logging on federal lands. The first of these is that a logged tree is more valuable than a standing tree. And this argument goes in several ways. One is that these trees are growing out there. All of that new growth is there, and it's just being wasted if we don't cut it down. The second of these reasons that people use to justify increased logging is that we have problems in our communities. We have unemployment in our communities, and that unemployment and those economic problems stem from the 1990 listing of the spotted owl as a threatened species under the ESA, the Endangered Species Act. That listing led to a reduction in logging on federal lands, and it certainly did. That reduction in logging caused the loss of jobs, a loss of incomes, a loss of county revenues. And so to fix those problems, all that we need to do is go back and increase the logging. Right? It's pretty linear there. So let's first of all talk about the value of the log trees. The governor's panel that Greg referred to started a year ago, and the charge of that panel was to bring representatives of the industry, the conservation community, and the counties to see if they could come up with a recommendation for increasing logging on the ONC lands. Part of that process actually considered what would the industry pay for these lands if, in fact, you privatize them. And the answer from the Department of Forestry is that the industry would pay about, on average, $5,000 an acre. Now, that's the value of the timber per acre out on these federal lands that we're talking about. That doesn't mean that that's what they would, that would be the value of an acre if they logged it tomorrow. That would be a lot larger, lot higher than that. But many of these lands would not be logged for 20, 25 years. And so the average present value is about $5,000 per acre. That's the value of the log tree. Now, the standing tree. We've known for a very long time that standing trees give us clean water. They slow down the water during the winter time so we don't have as much flooding. They hold water. They produce water later in the summer. They provide habitat for salmon and spotted owls and other things. Research since 1990 indicates that in the areas on federal lands where you have a concern about water and about habitat and about salmon, the value of these standing trees can be about $20,000 an acre. So there are some lands out there where the standing trees are worth $20,000 an acre. If you dedicated those lands, if you, in effect, allocated them to the timber industry, you would get $5,000 worth of timber. And then there's carbon. We didn't talk about carbon in 1990 as we were wrestling with spotted owls. As far as I know, and the experts who were involved in this process far more than I, never talked about carbon. But what we now know is that these federal lands in Western Oregon hold more carbon per acre than almost any other ecosystem in the world. If you log that timber, half of it is going to go up into the atmosphere. When it goes into the atmosphere, it is carbon dioxide, just like carbon dioxide that comes from burning fossil fuels. It contributes to climate change. It contributes to more frequent, more intense droughts, floods, heat waves, more intense, wider spreading insect infestation and disease outbreaks. Those effects damage people. They damage households, they damage businesses, they damage communities. Economists have looked at this and tried to figure out what is the damage per ton of carbon dioxide going up into the atmosphere. And earlier this year, about a dozen federal agencies brought their economists together, long process, and figured out that if you look at the studies that have been completed, or the studies that they considered as part of this process, the damage per ton of carbon dioxide would be about $40 to $80 per ton over the next couple of decades. If you put those numbers into the amount of carbon dioxide that would be released if you logged these federal acres rather than left them standing, the value of the damage from the carbon dioxide that would be released is about $25,000 per acre on average. But it's worse than that. Because this federal process, in fact, didn't consider a lot of the damage that carbon dioxide causes. It did not, for example, consider acidification of the oceans and the effects on food chains in the oceans and an awful lot of other things that happen out there. The federal process, very conservative, did not want to get killed in the political process that we have in Washington these days, and so they looked very conservatively at the literature that they included into their estimates. Other people who haven't been constrained by that estimate that the value per ton of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere would be about $250 per ton. If you plug that into the amount of carbon dioxide that would be released, if you logged these federal lands rather than left them standing, it's about $85,000 per acre. So here you have, we can log it and get $5,000 worth of timber, but we give up $85,000 worth of costs, of damage, for the carbon dioxide that would be released. Except it's worse than that. Two very major papers that were released last week that appear to be the precursors for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change major report that is due next year, say that A, number one, these effects, these damages that we expect from climate change that we've been talking about will occur in about 100 years. You know, it occurs to the next generation. It's going to occur within years, within a small number of decades, within our lifetimes. What that does is that means that those costs are closer to us. The cost estimate will go up. The second of the papers said, we've greatly overestimated how the climate is going to respond to carbon dioxide. Or we've underestimated that, rather. So what we're going to have to end up doing probably is we're going to have to start sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or the effects will be even worse than we anticipate. And if you look at the cost of sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we're talking about cost per acre of these federal lands that's greater than $85,000 per acre. So what this means is that, again, the value of a log tree out on these federal lands is not greater than the value of a standing tree, on average, on almost all of these lands. Maybe on some. We don't know yet, because to a great extent, the federal agencies haven't looked very hard at this issue. But in general, there's enough evidence that's out there that I think tells us that we ought to expect that the value of standing trees far exceeds the value of logging these trees. The benefits of leaving these trees standing exceeds the costs. Or alternatively, the costs of logging exceed the benefits of logging. Nonetheless, I know that Senator White knows about this. I expect that Representative DeFazio knows about this. I know that many of the county commissioners know about this because I gave much the same speech to them a couple weeks ago. They still want to log. All right? The costs exceed the benefits. They still think that we need to increase logging. Why is that? Well, because when we didn't log before, because of the spotted owl, we lost jobs, we lost incomes, we lost county revenues. We now need to increase logging and to fix those problems. So let's look at that. Research done by the Forest Service, economists in the Forest Service at the end of the 1990s, concluded that, yes, the timber industry in western Washington, Oregon, and northern California, the area where we have northern spotted owls, that industry lost about 30,000 jobs in the 1990s. But only one-third of that loss is attributable to the owls. Two-thirds of that reduction in jobs is because the industry itself has been cutting costs, has been laying workers off. Well, let's assume that about half of that accrues to Oregon, as a rough estimate. So what we have is that during the 1990s, the spotted owl, the reduction in logging on federal lands, cost us about 5,000 jobs in the timber industry, the other 10,000 jobs because the industry itself was cutting jobs. Let's put this into context. Why is the industry able to cut jobs like that? I think the reason why is because in the mid-1990s, the industry busted the unions. The timber industry unions were very powerful. The industry busted them in the 1980s, in the Reagan years. As a result, the industry was now able to take more of the value of a tree that otherwise would have gone to workers and hold on to that value itself. So they took the value of trees that otherwise would have gone to workers by laying workers off. Before they busted the unions, the timber industry in this state employed about 70,000 workers. It now employs about 25,000 workers. So during that period, we have lost about 45,000 workers in the wood products industry. About 5,000 of those 45 are attributable to the owl and environmental protections that Greg was talking about. The other 40,000 come from decisions by management and shareholders of these corporations. Increasing logging on federal lands is not going to bring those jobs back. It simply isn't. In addition to cutting jobs, the industry also cut wages for the remaining workers. Before it busted the unions, The average wage in the timber industry is about 40% higher than the average wage for all workers in the state. A recent estimate by the State Office of Economic Analysis is that the average wage within the timber industry is now slightly below the average for all workers in the state of Oregon. If the industry had not reduced wages that much, every one of those 25,000 workers in the timber industry now, on average, would earn an additional $30,000. Do the math. 25,000 workers, $30,000 per worker. It's $750 million a year that now goes to the shareholders of timber corporations rather than to workers. That's $750 million that does not go into Oregon's communities. And then the timber also took money away from communities. You see, the grand bargain that we had is that you have values of trees, and the value of those trees were shared between the shareholders of the companies, between the workers, and between the communities. And the communities got their share through taxes. And in 1990, Washington, Oregon, California, each one of those states had a timber harvest tax, a tax that went to support general governmental services. One of the primary rationales for that is that timber harvesting has bad impacts on communities. Well, part of that is that logging timber messes up the water. Well, somebody's got to clean that up, and so you pay taxes to help pay to clean that up. Another part of that is that the timber industry employment is very, very variable. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down. And so employment within the industry is not very stable. And unstable employment causes an awful lot of social problems. It causes poverty, it causes spousal abuse and child abuse and substance abuse and other things. And so the timber harvest tax in each of these states was to help compensate for that. But in 1993, in Oregon alone, the timber industry was able to go to the legislature and strike a deal to eliminate the timber harvest tax in this state. So now, the timber industry pays not a dime through a timber harvester tax to support general service government. Now, it does pay about $10 million, and they call it a forest products harvest tax, and they will say, yeah, we pay a harvest tax, but that is basically money from the left hand of the industry to the right, left pocket of the industry to the right pocket of the industry, because all of that money is used to support the industry. Part of it goes to support public relations through the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. It pays for forest research. It pays for fighting fires. It pays to implement the Oregon Forest Practices Act. None of it goes to support communities. If, and this is work that the Oregon Department of Forestry did as part of the governor's panel that Greg mentioned, if Oregon had a harvest tax the same as Washington's harvest tax, and appreciate that many of these corporations operate in Oregon and Washington just the same, if we had a harvest tax the same as Washington's, Oregon's counties would have received $40 million in 2011. So that's the amount of money that, again, the industry has taken away from communities. Increasing logging on federal lands, I don't see, is going to fix that problem. So what do we do? Well, I think the first thing that we do is we get away from this dichotomy of and this controversy and this battle of, do we log or do not log? Let's manage logs. Let's manage forest lands, rather. Let's manage them to optimize the benefits. Right? If cutting down a tree, if the benefits of cutting down that tree exceed the cost, cut down the tree. If the costs of cutting down a tree exceed the benefits, don't cut it down. It's pretty simple. And let's do that. What that means is that we have to start managing federal lands for the benefits. And one of the primary benefits is carbon. So let's figure out what we need to do to manage these lands to optimize the amount of carbon that's out there. This is a big deal. You know, we have major carbon markets taking place in California on the East Coast. There are seven of them. Well, there are only four of them now in China, but they're developing three more. We have major corporations are now accounting for the value of carbon. Disney, for example, accounts for the value of carbon. Microsoft accounts for the value of carbon. On our federal lands, do we account for the value of carbon? Nope. In the Wyden bill, does it account for the value of carbon? No. In the DeFazio bill, does it account for the value of carbon? No. When you don't account for the costs of something and you only look at what you think are the benefits and the costs exceed the benefits, that is a prescription for a society to rapidly go to a lower standard of living. We increase our standard of living only when we make decisions the benefits exceed the costs. We also ought to be managing these resources for other benefits, for the recreation, for the water, for the salmon, and the like. Let me put that in context. Under the Wyden bill, we would see an increase in timber jobs of about 1,600 total over the next 20 years. And actually, it would go down because the industry keeps cutting labor, right? Under the DeFazio bill, which would, in effect, industrialize logging on 1.6 million acres, you would see 5,500 jobs total. And it's probably less than that because the industry is cutting jobs. So somewhere between 1,600 and 5,500 jobs in the timber industry if we do that. In contrast, if we focused on managing these lands for outdoor recreation, the outdoor recreation in this industry has 140,000 jobs in the state of Oregon, compared to 25,000 jobs in the timber industry. Since 2005, so during the recession, the outdoor recreation industry added about 7,000 jobs per year. It's increasing jobs rather than decreasing jobs. So there is an alternative where we can get more jobs, get more income, by managing these lands for the benefits, for the net benefits, rather than just do we log it or not log it. Managing lands for recreational amenities, for clean water, for salmon and the like, has another benefit that I don't think very many people are talking about, but is certainly starting to receive an awful lot of attention among pretty serious economists across the United States, and that is, throughout all of our history, those of us in this room, the economy of the United States grew in large part because the workforce was growing on average about 2.5% a year. Those workers were producing new things. Those new workers and their families were consuming new things, and so we had economic growth. As the baby boom generation starts to retire, we are going to see the workforce grow at a much, much smaller rate. What that means is that some places will be able to hold on to talent, and they'll continue to grow. They'll continue to see increasing prosperity. Other areas are not going to be able to hold on to talent, and they're going to have much more of a challenge. As we manage federal lands for clean water, recreational opportunities, for fishing and the like, we have a better opportunity. In fact, that is our only major opportunity to attract talent to the state of Oregon, hold on to that talent, and to generate new jobs, new incomes, new revenues in industries across the board, having nothing to do with timber or forests even. The third thing that we need to do is pay attention to the disparity in incomes. If you've been paying attention, this certainly is starting to receive an awful lot of attention from the president and from political leaders. We saw it last year with the Occupy Wall Street and all of that, and it's basically that nearly all of the increase in income for a very long period of time has gone to the 1%. Now, maybe you belong to that, but I don't, so I'm stuck in the 99%. And I thought until very recently that basically what we're talking about was, again, Wall Street versus the rest of us out here on Main Street, Oregon, Main Street, United States. Again, however, analysis put together by the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis is exactly the same if we look just within the boundaries of Oregon. Since 1990, the top 1% has seen their incomes go up. The bottom 80% has seen their incomes go down. If we don't fix that, we can save all the trees, we can cut all the trees, and we're still going to see a tremendous amount of poverty, a tremendous amount of economic distress out in our communities. We can't fix that. We can't fix that, for example, by changing the political decisions that were made in the Reagan years and other years that weaken the ability of labor to hold on to its share of the value from timber or from any other activities. The fourth thing that we need to do is we need to fix our tax system. Part of that has to do with the timber harvest tax that I talked about. Part of it also has to do with the property tax system that we have in this state, where we see counties such as Curry County and Josephine County not having enough money to pay for sheriff services and health services and the like, simply because people don't want to pay property taxes. And how do we get that fixed? Until we get that fixed, then funneling new money into a county system that is basically broken is still going to leave it broken. So why don't I stop there and we can go to whatever questions you have, John. Thank you.
You are tuned to KLCC Eugene, 89.7, 90.5 KLCO Newport, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, and on the web at klcc.org.
Our first questioner today is Nick Smith. Nick leads the organization called Healthy Forest, Healthy Communities, and it describes itself as a grassroots coalition created to support congressional action on a comprehensive and permanent solution to restore the health of federal forest lands and nearby rural communities. Nick?
Sure. Gentlemen, thank you for your presentation, and thank you, City Club, for giving me the opportunity to be the first questioner. My question relates to a couple of issues that were mentioned during the presentation. There was a mention of a statistic that Oregon's recreation industry supports over 140,000 jobs here in the state and adds a billion to the economy. This number from the Outdoor Industry Association indicates that a majority of recreation dollars are spent on motorized recreation, such as boating, RVs, off-road vehicle use and motorcycling, and other pursuits that require access to roads, forest roads, roads access, such as hunting, camping, bicycling, and most snow sports. In the publication on your website on exploring the economics of how we deal with the OMC lands, there's a suggestion that more active management of these lands would harm the recreation economy. So as Congressman DeFazio has proposed increasing ONC timber harvest while expanding wilderness areas, scenic and river designations, are there studies, research, any information, that tells us that, this proposal in particular would harm Oregon's recreation economy or reduce recreation opportunities?
Thanks for the question, Nick. I don't know of any specific research that would address that, but let me speak to it broadly. The road network that you speak of that allows access to these lands, as I mentioned, 3 to 6 times the densities that are protective of fish. Perhaps even more significantly, the agencies in charge of managing these roads, they don't have the budgets to maintain them. These are continuing liabilities that are chronic sources of sediment across the landscape. There's just no ability to maintain that type of infrastructure anymore due to budget cutbacks. There's a desire to maintain it. There's a desire to reduce it so it's more sustainable. But if you having been involved in various travel management processes and other planning processes that deal with primarily off-road vehicle use, we know there's impacts from those, but we also know that they're a large part of the recreational economy. I think there's easily an achievable balance of a road system that works for recreation and works for aquatic conservation. but we're not there yet.
Yeah, this is Ernie. Is this on? Okay. As far as studies specific to, say, the DeFazio bill, the Wyden bill, no. As far as I haven't seen any of that, and I haven't heard from their offices that they've conducted or anybody else has conducted that. What we do know is that these lands have never been managed primarily for recreation. Recreation was always an afterthought, something that came along after the agencies realized and political leaders realized they had to do something rather than just cut the trees down. We have an awful lot of literature, though, that applies here. We know, for example, that counties that are next to or include areas that are wilderness or are managed in effect for wilderness, whether they're designated or not, see an increase in population, see an increase in jobs, see an increase in incomes. They tend to see an increase in especially entrepreneurs, some types of entrepreneurs. So we see that lands that are managed not for commodity production, so it's not for timber, it's not for mining, it's not for energy, tend to see people move in those directions. They certainly do, and they stay in those directions. They're called quality of life migrants, is one way that we think about that. A major study conducted in the end of the 1990s found that if you looked at the interstate variation in job growth, right, some states grew faster than others. How do you explain that? About half of that variation is explained because the states have different industries. About half of that, the other half, however, is explained because the states were able to attract different numbers of people. And to a great extent, that occurs in the western states, to some extent the southern states, that have been able to attract people because they offer a high quality of life. In 2003, I authored a letter that was eventually signed by more than 100 economists from the West, including a couple of Nobel laureates. And the sort of the summary statement of that was that the Western states' environmental quality is arguably its single most important economic strength.
And now it's time to take a short break for you to compose your questions. We do have a little limitation on time today. Remember, anyone may help compose a question, but only City Club members may ask a question. So we'll take our break now. You're listening to Greg Holler and Ernie Niemi at the December 13th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Now it's time for questions from our members on the topic of managing the ONC forest lands, perspectives of a conservationist and an economist.
John DeLow, City Club, and thank you, gentlemen, for all the bad news. I would like a little more clarity on how exactly road building is so detrimental to water quality, because I understand you have to scrape it and everything, but if the road's not anywhere near a stream.
Sure. Thank you for the question. Think of roads on the landscape, that we have. We have very steep slopes. We have a lot of water coming off of those slopes. If a road isn't constructed properly, meaning if it's not outsloped and it doesn't put water, if it doesn't channelize the water in a ditch, but actually diverts the water onto the forest floor, that works fine. However, most of these roads are not developed correctly, and it ends up channelizing water, sending it through a culvert, which often plugs because it's very hard to maintain the large number of these culverts that are on the landscape. That sets up a situation where you have no place for the water to go. You get a snow or rain on snow event, and you create the opportunity for the road to just completely blow out. That sediment then heads downhill into a river. Some of these culverts, it's called hydrologically connected. Some of these roads are hydrologically connected to streams through these culverts, and that's how we get sediment into roads.
James Baldock, I've been a member since 2012. My question's for Ernie. You cited a model that basically valued an acre of forest land based on the carbon emission it captures. I believe you cited about 80,000 an acre. We were wondering if your model accounts for forest fires or how that affects the amount of carbon captured and the value of that acre.
Well, I'm an economist. I'm not a forest scientist, so I'm going to have to rely on what I've heard from them. And in particular, what I've heard from scientists at Oregon State University, and by the way, this is research that they have done over there within the past few years, headed by a scientist named Mark Harmon, Beverly Law, and Olga Krankina. And what they say is that in the state of Oregon, or west side of the state of Oregon, logging accounts for far more release of carbon dioxide into the air than forest fires does. And one of the examples that they give is the Biscuit Fire, you know, a very, very large fire, the largest fire that we've had since the Tillamook burn fires, that even that year, the amount of carbon released from the Biscuit Fire was less than the amount of carbon released through logging that year. So yes, some is released, but fire is at least so far, is not nearly the threat to the climate that logging is.
Thanks for coming today. I'm Dan Solitz, City Club member. Our table was wondering if you could further address in more detail the distribution of the costs and the benefits. So a lot of the benefits you mentioned for a standing tree are global, but at least countrywide, and the costs of that standing tree a lot of times accrue more to the local communities. Now, I know there's a lot of rosy things you've said about the future of communities in forest areas, but I've been to Oak Ridge, and I think what you're talking about is in the future. So what about closer to now and distributing those costs and benefits?
Yeah, that's a great question. And some of the response to that I can give as an economist. I think some of the response you have to look into your own heart and decide what the answer is. Addressing that part, if you think that cutting down trees and releasing carbon dioxide so that you can get a job in Oak Ridge is worth increasing the hurricane in Philippines that kills however many people, you think that's okay, then you have to answer that with your heart. That's not an economic issue at all. In terms of economics, some work that my colleagues and I did several years back for the Climate Leadership Initiative here in town looked at the costs to households in Oregon of climate change under a business as usual. If we continued the way that we have been, and by the way, we're continuing even more than we thought at that time. And at that time, we were looking at the cost to households being above $2,500 on average in the state of Oregon within 2020, 2030. I forget what the target date was that we had. We certainly see some of the issues that maybe were lurking in the first question of what happens with fires. We know that as we release carbon dioxide here, we can anticipate more fires, more homes burning down because of fires. We can anticipate more bugs. We can anticipate more bugs that attack ecosystems, more bugs that attack us. We actually have research in this region that says that the additional heat waves in Portland and Seattle, and you sort of say heat waves in Portland and Seattle, you know, well, in fact, they do occur, and they occur far more frequently than they used to, and they do kill people. So again, you know, how many people do you have to kill before it makes a difference if it isn't your family or if it isn't you?
I'm sorry, but we are out of time. If the speakers can stick around and answer your personal questions afterwards, we'll be glad to have them do that. Thank you for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club discussion of managing ONC forest lands, perspectives of a conservationist and an economist. Let's show our appreciation. I note that the report that Ernie wrote for the Pacific Rivers Council is available on their website at pacificrivers.org. And I would like to send a special thanks to John DeWinter, Vincenzo Scarpacci, and Joanne Ernst. I note that their first program had the scientist whose science went into the Wyden bill, so they were predicting the future with their programs. Thanks again to our sponsors, John H. Brown of Evans, Elder & Brown, Network Charter School, Dot Dodson's Photography, PAC Info, and Marilyn Milne Public Relations Services, and Essex General Construction. We meet next on December 20th at the Eugene Hilton for our last program of 2013, our annual Gifts to the City program. Thank you for coming.